Now sentenced to 22 years in jail. In this last minute, looking at the final vocal report, looking at Turkey and Jordan, the U.S. corporations like Volvo and Daimler Chrysler, and putting Dr. Dafir into this.
Well, the impression one gets is the U.S. government is going after the weak and those who can't defend themselves. Although in this case, there seems to be more than perhaps meets the eye. It's more than sanctions breaking, which, as you rightly said, Voices in the Wilderness has done. I think this report we have now, which is supposed to be the final report, actually raises questions, some of which may be answered by congressional committees, which are looking into some of the improprieties under the Bremer period and other occupation activities and diversion of monies to Halliburton and Halliburton ripping off the Pentagon, for example. Some of this will continue. Whether Volcker will continue, although he perhaps should, having raised questions and no answers, that remains to be seen.
Dennis Halliday, former assistant UN Secretary General and head of the UN Humanitarian Program of Iraq until he resigned his post in protest of U.S.-led sanctions. And Barry Gawantar, who heads the Central New York chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. That does it for today's broadcast. You can go to our website to see video photographs if you're a radio listener. You can also get our podcast there at democracynow.org. We have our transcripts as well as headlines in Spanish in audio and transcript form. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Again, you can sign up for our daily headlines at our website at democracynow.org. Have a good weekend. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to CFRU Radio 93.3 FM. Good for you and good for your community.
Welcome to Going Global, a new show on CFRU that features interviews with Guelph students who have studied, worked, traveled, and done research abroad. We have a guest host with me here today, April. Howard, would you introduce yourself?
Oh, hello. Yes, I'm just standing in for Nikki, who's away this week. She'll be back next week.
Great. And we've got with us as our guest today, who we're going to be interviewing, Deepa Swaminathan. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, I'm Deepa. I am a grad student here at the University of Guelph in Rural Extension Studies, and I did my research in Bangladesh, so I'm going to talk a bit about that today.
कर दे जाए।
Was a song by Kiran Ahluwalia. She's a Toronto-based artist who does modern interpretations of Punjabi folk songs with a Celtic fiddler, Natalie McMaster. So we're going to go now to our interview with Deepa. Could you tell us a little bit about your background, Deepa, where you're from and where you've traveled to?
Sure, April. I'm actually from Guelph. I'm a Guelphite originally, and I came back. I'm a teacher by background. I used to teach for about 5 years before coming back to grad school, and in terms of travel, I have done some traveling through Europe and to visit my family in India bunches of times. And I had a brief teaching stint in Brazil, and then, of course, the Bangladesh trip.
Could you tell us a little bit about Bangladesh? What were you doing there, and maybe a little bit about Bangladesh in general?
Sure. Bangladesh, it's actually kind of funny, because before I went to Bangladesh, I had a lot of people asking me if it was a separate country from India. Like most people I talked to, not most, I shouldn't say most, but there was a few people who thought that it was a state in India, so that was interesting. But it's located, of course, right northeast of India, and it's a very small delta nation geographically, but it's quite populated. The reason that I went to Bangladesh was because I was looking at microcredit, and microcredit sort of originated in Bangladesh. So that's really what brought me there.
And can you tell us a little bit about why you chose to look at microcredit?
That's a good question. I guess when I first came back to school, I was looking for a potential thesis topic, and I was sort of looking at a lot of different areas. And one thing that really struck me, I guess, about microcredit was a film that I watched in one of my classes, and it was profiling BRAC, which is one of the NGOs that I was working with. And the film really was talking about how the women, when they first join a microcredit organization, they have to get past so many obstacles. And there's actually a lot of research that shows that most of the women who join microcredit organizations are subject to an increase in domestic abuse as soon as they join. And that goes on for months and months until things settle down or money comes in or whatever. And I thought that was so interesting, because I thought it was interesting how an NGO, knowing that women would be subject to abuse, like, how do you know it's a good development strategy? You know, like, does the end justify the means? And so that's sort of how I got interested in looking into microcredit.
That's an interesting connection. I wouldn't have thought of that either. So you said you work with BRAC. I understand you work with two microcredit organizations. Can you tell us about those organizations and how you found them?
Sure. Basically what I was looking at was, I was interested in looking at development communication in microcredit. I chose to go to Bangladesh because that's where microcredit began, and the Grameen Bank is really the originator of microcredit, they're thought to be, at least. So I was working with the Grameen Bank in BRAC, and they have fairly similar programs in terms of dispersing credit. So I thought that my research would sort of be a comparative study. It's not. It's a case study, but it could, I suppose, could be, but it's not. Anyway, so I was looking at the two organizations, and basically what they do is they disperse small loans to women, and the women repay the loans in a weekly installment that's the same sum each week. And that money's collected by a field worker who travels to each village, sets up a group meeting, and collects the money person by person. Each of the field workers visits two different villages a day. Oh, sorry, that's not true. They visit many different villages a day, and they work 5 days a week. So quite a busy job.
And how did you find working with them in terms of just getting in contact with them and them accepting you to come do your research? Were they open to that?
Actually, that was one of the most amazing things. I wasn't expecting it, but everything was set up before I even went. Like, when I had emailed people, I heard back from them. Everybody was so helpful and accommodating. So it was wonderful. I had total support in the field, so it was great.
That sounds great. Okay, yeah. We're going to go to another song, and when we come back, we're going to continue the interview with Deepa. If you have any questions for Deepa, you can give us a call here at the studio. The number is 837-2378.
Thank you.
So that was the very wonderful voice of Alka Yagnik. Now, the title of that track itself is Sanwariya, Sanwariya, and it's from actually from a film track, the film Suarez, which relates quite well to today's discussion, because it's actually about this bright young scientist played by Shah Rukh Khan, who then comes back from the States to India and gets interested then in rural development and looking at it from a grassroots level. So I think that ties in quite well with our discussion on microcredit. So microcredit, Deepa, it isn't really like then banking here, is it?
I don't think it is, really. I mean, technically it is. I mean, it's dispersing loans and repaying the loans with interest. So it's exactly banking, but it's a very different process. It's much more interactive. It's much more built around relationships, I think, than banking here is, definitely. And there's no machines over there.
Okay. So, I mean, do you find that people interact differently between, say, the bank and then the clients?
You mean in Bangladesh, at the head office versus in the field?
Maybe, or perhaps also you can tell us something about what the experience is like then for the customers.
That's a good question. It's interesting. Well, I was I did focus groups with the loan recipients to sort of figure that out or get a sense of that, and the sense generally seems to be that. I actually thought that a lot of the loan recipients would sort of feel maybe burdened by having to attend these weekly meetings, because I had read a lot about how these meetings sometimes can go for hours in length, and it's very difficult for women to be away from their day for that amount of time. But when I had spoken to them, the women I had spoken to didn't say that. Like, they said it was a great opportunity to get together as a community. It was a great opportunity to interact with somebody new. And it was really sort of like it was a give and take of information. It was a true exchange in that sense. Like, it wasn't about a man coming, collecting all this money and saying, start building sanitary latrines and don't eat food that's been left outside. Or like, it wasn't a lecturing at all. It was very much an equal exchange. So it was quite a nice environment, I thought.
And you said just then that, in fact, it was a man coming, and you talked about the clients being women. Was that
right.
a tendency you found?
In the Grameen Bank, the vast majority of their clients are women. In BRAC, the majority is women, but they also have programs designed just for men as well. With both organizations, they have more male field workers than female field workers, and they're trying to change that, and by each year they have more and more, a higher proportion of females. But it's been said that it's just not that desirable of a job for many women, because it involves a lot of travel, a lot of the time by bicycle, and in various places in the country, that's not really socially acceptable. And for example, the Grameen Bank refuses to allow its female field workers to use bicycles, because there has been a backlash, and there have been a couple of women who have been mugged and killed, who are field workers, as a result of that. And it's pretty crazy. But conversely, with BRAC, one of their conditions is that all women must ride bicycles, because they want to send. It's because they want to send a message. You know, but because of that, because in Grameen Bank the women can't ride bicycles, when I was there they had to leave the office, the field office, an hour and a half before the men every morning. You know, and it's like, that's not easy to do, you know. So it's a tough job, I think, and in particular for women because of that.
So do you see some differences then between the two banks that you were looking at, Grameen Bank and BRAC?
There were lots of differences, actually. Like, They're similar enough so I could sort of draw some comparisons, but BRAC has a very comprehensive program that they have a social development program in place. They use a lot of popular theater. They have a very big legal awareness program in place, which is amazing. They have lawyers on site, actually, and they work in conjunction with the Bangladesh National Women's Lawyers Association, I think they're called. I think that's the right order of those words. And a health program, and actually BRAC is known, not for microcredit, but it's known for its education program, its non-formal primary education program. And it's interesting because through the education program, BRAC has built up its name so much that now it's one of the most powerful brands in Bangladesh. So now they've gotten into department stores, and they have a dairy, a whole dairy institute, and people buy it like crazy because all over the country people know it and trust it. So it's pretty interesting. And Grameen Bank doesn't have that. Grameen Bank is simply a bank.
So with BRAC, do then the consumers have a sense that they're helping the community or...?
BRAC has a chain of stores called Arong stores. Actually, I think that there's one in Vancouver. I saw that on the website, but I'm not really sure if that's true. I've never actually followed that up. But they do have one in London. And they basically sell all the products that their clients make. And so it's pretty, so I guess it's basically like a whole fair trade store. And the people who visit those stores do have a sense because all the products have tags on them that say.
So what are the loans usually used for? What do people get money for?
The loans typically are used to start up a business. And the businesses are typically buying some chickens or a cow or a sewing machine or setting up a little shop. Generally, the women seemed to prefer businesses that they could operate out of the home. So, and the loans themselves are not very large in size. They might go up to a couple of $100 maximum. So,
and is there a difference between what the bank thinks that the money is being used for and what the money is actually used for once it's received?
Actually, that's a great question. There's a lot of literature around that because there's a lot of literature sort of around who is actually spending the money from the loans. And in a lot of cases, they find that it's the men. And where is that money going? And in a lot of cases, they're finding that it's not going to the business and it's going into other things like gambling or just other expenditures. But I guess one way that they sort of make sure that the money is being used for what it's meant to be used is because they have a group lending model, and both Grameen Bank and BRAC operate on this. And what it basically is that women have to arrange themselves in groups of five, and that sort of acts as their collateral, because if one of them is unable to repay at a particular week and they have to forfeit, the other women have to step up and put in that money. So as a result, it's really difficult for women to have to forfeit, because it then creates social problems as well.
And the women are willing to put themselves in a position where they might be responsible for somebody else's loan?
They are, because the only alternative they have is rural moneylenders, which still operate all over the world. But they charge exorbitant fees and interest is through the roof. And so it's really a good alternative. And it generally seems to work, although there still are stories that you still hear about it not working. Like, for example, the one thing that I noticed was that single women, like women who had either been divorced or abandoned or widowed, did not find microcredit successful for them, as much so as married women who had a husband who was a willing participant. And I think the reason why that is because the money is shared between the spouses and it's invested sort of jointly. But when they don't have that option, the money sort of disappears somewhere. Or if they don't have a husband who's cooperating and spending the money where it needs to be spent, the money is gone. The women have no way of paying it back. And they're the ones responsible for it, not the husbands. And the widowed or divorced or abandoned women didn't really have the option because it was difficult for them to leave their homes. It was difficult for them to have investments.
So it's not actually reaching some of the most vulnerable sections of society?
It's definitely not, no.
And did they have any options then if they were wanting to start their own business or anything?
With the Grameen Bank, has a new program and it's targeted towards rural beggars. And that program involves interest-free loans that are payable at any rate and any amount and at any point. And you can forfeit at any point too. So it's much more flexible than the other loans available to the other women. BRAC also has a program that targets specifically what they call the ultra-poor, which are essentially those same women. And that group is just women who do not have a husband. So there's no male member in their family. So that, in BRAC's case, they have asset transfers, they get training, there's a lot of sort of investment initially that the organization puts into the women so they can sustain their business when they start.
So say, for example, I was wanting to get a microcredit loan. How would I know whether to go to a rural lender or one of these banks or one of these special programs that you're talking about?
You know, it's a good question. I think I wonder about that 30 years ago when it started, when people really didn't know about it. Because now, in every village, in every village in Bangladesh. Like, when you look at a map of Bangladesh and you look at the coverage of the Grameen Bank in BRAC, it's literally in every village. Like, it's, and they're still expanding, and I don't understand where they're actually going because it's covered. And there's BRAC, there's Grameen Bank, but there's so many other microcredit organizations. There's one called ASA, there's one called Proshika, there's government-funded ones. Every rural person does have access to a credit organization. I don't know how they choose which one they go to be honest. I would assume that it has a lot to do with what they hear from their community members about it. But a lot of them have had experiences with moneylenders and then ended up in the microcredit programs. So I think that that's a part of it.
Mm. And do you know where the money that's being lent comes from? Is this coming from big international donors, or how is the money being raised?
Grameen Bank now is self-sustainable, so they do not take any money from anyone else anymore. They did at the beginning. BRAC still does, but they are trying to wean themselves off of that. Actually, they get a lot of money from CETA. That's one of their biggest donors. But because of the interest that they charge, they're able to recover most of their money and then more. So it is conceivable that in the very near future, they wouldn't need external donors either for their credit program. But BRAC also has many other programs that they need external money for. Hmm.
Okay, we're going to go to another song. And if you have any questions for Deepa, our number here at the studio is 837-2378. And we'll be back with Going Global on CFRU.
ஒரு நிலைக்குள் நிறுத்த உதம் சல்லிதியை கடைகள் பார்வையா கடையில் இல்லையே காதருள் செய்யும் எங்கள் கருணை தெய்வமே கடைகள் பார்வையா கடையில் என்னையே காதருள் செய்யும் எங்கள் கருணை தெய்வமே கடைக்கலம் என்று உந்தன் திருவடி தன்னில் மகராஜன் பாடி நீதம் பணிந்திடுவேன் மகராஜன் பாடி நிதம் பணிந்திடுவேன் மகராஜன் பாடி நிதம் பணிந்திடுவேன் தாம் தகிடஜம் மதபக தகிடஜம் ததாம் தமா இதாம் தகிடஜம் மதபக தகிடஜம் ததாம் தமா இதாம் தகிடஜம் மதபக தகிடஜம் ஜனுத திமித திமித ஜனுத தாம் தகிடஜம் மதபக தகிடஜம் ஜனுத திமித திமித ஜனுத தாம் தகிடஜம் மதபக தகிடஜம் ஜனுத திமித திமித ஜனுத தகி தகுதாம் தகுதில்லன தில்லன தக தகித திமித தோம் ததோம் தக தகித திமித தோம் ததோம் தக தகித திமித தோம் ததோம்
Oh, sorry, that was my line. That song was Athilana by Maharajapuram Santhanam. And I chose this is actually this is Indian music. I was supposed to bring music from Bangladesh, but of course I didn't have any. So this is Indian. Maybe it's close enough. I don't know. Anyway, the reason I chose this song is because I used to dance Bharatanatyam for many, many years. And this was my favorite kind of dance, this particular song. This is called the Athilana. And what makes it so exciting is that normally in Bharatanatyam, which is like the South Indian classical dance, your dances tell a story and they're quite intricate and some of them are really long. But the Athilanas are just these fun bursts of energy. They're like jigs, I guess. So that's why I chose it.
So we've been talking quite a bit about the banking side of Grameen Bank and BRAC and such like, but your research actually wasn't focused on the mechanics of handing out loans.
No, that's true.
So you were looking at things like communications and the relationships involved there. Do you want to tell us all a little bit about that?
Sure. I was interested in the relationships because BRAC is the largest NGO in the world, actually. And the Grameen Bank is like operating on billions of dollars now. They're both massive, massive organizations. And I just think it's fascinating that they have like essentially one person as the liaison between that huge organization and all of these women all over the country. So I was really interested in sort of what's kind of going on in between that, you know, like what is the information that's passing and is it passing one way? Is it just a question of these field workers traveling to villages and, you know, and lecturing them on what they need to be doing? Or is there a chance for women to have feedback and to say, you know what, like we're paying too high interest or we want to learn more about you know, chicken immunization or whatever. I was just really interested in sort of seeing, I guess, how the feedback was working, you know, and I guess maybe how that communication or that sense of relationship was helping or hindering the microcredit and helping or hindering the whole idea of empowerment for these women.
And so what sort of techniques were you actually using then?
As my research?
Out in the field, yeah.
I was doing interviews with field workers to get a sense of basically how they operate, what their mandates are, what they learned about in their training, and what they sort of perceive their role to be in the organization. I was doing focus groups with the loan recipients to get a sense of what their experience has been with the organization, how long that they've been there, what it's been like, what their field worker has been like with them. And I did interviews with some people at the head offices of both organizations to get a sense, again, about the policies about communication. Because communication is actually a very big part of microcredit. because even in the Grameen Bank, which sort of bills itself as strictly a financial institution, at the ends of their weekly meetings, they set aside 15 minutes of time in which to talk about social issues. And that is something that the field workers get from their superiors that they need to do. So clearly, the communication is a key component. But they have a lot of discretion in terms of what they discuss, how they discuss, and they get very little training on how to actually communicate effectively. So the interviews with the people at the head office were just to sort of figure out what the policies were, what the training manual said about communication.
Okay. So you're coming from academia. You have your way of viewing the world.
Right.
Okay. And then you're talking with loan recipients in Bangladesh who have their take on things. How did you find that gap you're trying to bridge?
Well, that's funny because when I was there, I didn't really feel, you know, like I was coming from academia, you know, like I didn't use big fancy words or anything. But I felt that there was more a bridge to be gapped because I was a foreigner coming and I didn't know the language or the culture really. But yeah, I think maybe that's one of the reasons why I was really comfortable with the research, because it really wasn't very academic once I was in the field. Right? I mean, it has very little theory involved. Like, once you actually get there, you're actually just talking to people and getting a sense of it. And, you know, like, when you say a sense of it, like, it's such a loose term, but when you're doing sort of a case study, that's kind of what it is, right? Like, you're just trying to sort of paint a complete picture of what you are seeing based on what you experience and what you can tell from other people's experiences as well. So I was really comfortable with it.
So I guess now you've got to bridge that gap in your own head. Now you're trying to get it on paper.
Yeah, well, this is the problem, Howard, because now I'm like bridging back into academia and I'm really not an academic at all. So now it's time for the fancy big words, which, you know, I don't really know many of.
So how was it out there then? I mean, how did you find talking with people? I mean, and working with them? You had a translator.
I did. For my research, I did have a translator and she was great. We got along really great. So that was a real nice part. This is what I think. I think because I looked familiar to the people who I was interviewing, I really felt like I had an advantage in a way. Like, nobody really made a big deal about me. When I was there, I dressed like everybody else there, and most people didn't even realize that I was different. They would start talking to me in Bengali all the time, and they would just keep on forgetting. And I really loved that because I never really felt like anything was a... I never really felt kind of like a foreigner. You know, sometimes like you hear these stories of people who travel to places and they just always feel like they're on display and everyone follows them around. And like, I really didn't have that experience at all. So it was actually very comfortable. Like, I would ask questions through the translator, of course, and people would respond very frankly to me. I'm not sure what people's experiences are, maybe who do look more like quote unquote foreigners, but my experience was totally comfortable. It was as if, like, we were just friends, like our family, just talking, just chatting like this.
So what was the more challenging aspects for you then?
What were the challenging? Well, I mean, it was challenging. I don't really know why this is, but it was challenging to have a translator at all. Like, it was challenging to know that I would be asking a question through the translator. It's kind of like a leap of faith, right? Like, when you just sort of expect that that person is saying exactly what you want them to say, with the emphasis on what you really are trying to get at, and then the response that you get is translated really the way that you mean. Like, my translator and I had like these very heated arguments about some specific words. Like she would say a specific word and I'd be like, but what does that mean? You know, srinkala was one, that's a Bengali word, and I still don't even really know what it means. It means something like discipline, but it's not really discipline, like in the way that we visualize it. It's like a different kind, but she couldn't really express to me what that was, and I found that really frustrating. Like, I wish that I knew the language, but of course that, you know, that in an ideal world, of course you would, but...
But it sounds quite a rewarding experience. I mean...
Oh, yeah.
How in particular, what was your most sort of... What's the one thing that you sort of come back with, a sense of, yeah, that was worth it because of this, or...
Like, in terms of what I saw related to microcredit, or just my whole travel experience, you mean?
I think your whole time out there.
Well, it was just so exciting to be in a place on my own and you know, and really get a chance to, like, see the beauty in things. Like, what, that's, I mean, it's kind of trite to say, right? But it certainly wasn't the World Vision commercial that I was expecting to walk into, you know, like, naked infants running around with distended bellies and people crying. And, like, there's so much joy and there's so much peace, really, that you just get a sense of it. Like, it's almost a funny kind of thing to think that, you know, I guess this is another problem with development or what we think of development, right? Because here we are as Westerners and we go over there and we say, like, oh, your life will be made so much more easy if you, you know, privatize healthcare, because look at how great everything is for us. But then you think, like, what are we really imparting, you know? Like, what can we learn from this? Because there's this simplicity and this beauty in the way that they are with what they have. And it's not a lot, but it's just wonderful to see. It's cheesy, I know, but that's how I felt.
And what did you find about the communication? Did you find that people were understanding what you were asking about and what you were trying to get at? I mean, it's very intangible.
The idea of communication. Yeah, that was a difficult one because in a lot of cases, actually, particularly with the women I was interviewing, they weren't really used to expressing sort of how they felt about the field worker. You know, when I would ask, you know, like, what do you think of him? Like, is he, you know, essentially getting at, is he a nice guy? Like, is he nice to you? Like, do you like him? And their answers were like, yes, he's a good, you know, worker. And so that was kind of a tough one because it seems like that's a relation that really has not been thought about for them, and so it was hard for me to get that out of them.
And what did you find in terms of what they would say about the communication? Do you have anything in particular, just like a couple short things you could tell us about how were they conceptualizing the communication then with the field workers who would come out to see them?
One of the interesting stories I heard when I was out there was it was with the Grameen Bank, and I was mentioning earlier they had that beggars program, and it's really interesting because these beggars, of course, like what they basically do is they go from house to house and they collect a handful of rice, and then with all the rice they collect in a day they sell it at the market for money, and whatever they don't sell they eat, and but they're these pariahs because they have to go from town to town to town because no one has that kind of rice to keep on giving them every single day. And when I met one of them when I first got to Bangladesh, this is probably my first couple of weeks of being there, and I was talking to her through my translator, and she had just recently joined the Grameen Bank, like a couple of weeks prior. And she was talking about her experience, and she was saying that when she first joined, the field worker came to her and said, you know, like, you know, how are you? And she broke down and cried because no one had ever asked her that before, right? Like how she was. Mm. And I just thought that was really an interesting story because in a lot of cases, I don't think that, like, there's a sense of identity really that's lacking, like that, wait a minute, what about me? That feeling that people just don't really stop to think about. And I think that the field workers really play a role in sort of saying, you know, like, you're worth it. Like, how are you really? You might be just a beggar, but, you know.
Yeah. We're going to go to one more song now. This is a Toronto-based band called Auto Rickshaw, and we'll come back and talk with Deepa a little bit more about her experiences. Our number here at the studio, 837-2378.
Bye.
well, as April said, that was Auto Rickshaw from Toronto, in fact. In fact, I remember seeing them about a year or so ago now at the Jazz Festival here in Guelph. So, Deepa, what were essentially some of the main things, your findings then from your research?
Well, let's see. I guess one of the major findings that I sort of talked about earlier was just how important that interpersonal communication is in microcredit, particularly. And I think sort of one of the next steps out of this, I think, would be to have a better sort of sense of how to visualize that for the organizations themselves, like to come up with training for the field workers and to come up with supporting documents so they have some sort of way to, you know, improve. And the communication that goes on is great, like there's no question, but a lot of it is intuitive. And I think that it really sort of relies on, like, the compassion, really, of the field worker, which, and they certainly have it, you know, in Oodles, which is wonderful, but, you know, there are also some field workers who perhaps could benefit from more sort of direction in terms of communication, not only in terms of skills necessarily, but even the importance of it, why it's necessary, like why these things need to be talked about, right?
So you're hoping to provide some feedback then to the organizations, or have you done that already?
I did that at Grameen Bank. I had to prepare a paper and give a presentation at the head office, and at BRAC I prepared a paper as well. So,
and are you hopeful for them implementing some recommendations?
Or? Well, actually, yeah, I've been in touch with the Grameen Bank since then, and they have put some things into practice, which is pretty exciting to think that, you know, something actually can come out of my thesis besides 100 pages of nothing.
Mm. And have they said anything in particular that they might be implementing? Do you know what they might do with it?
What direction it sort of was going in when I left the Grameen Bank? And I came back at the end of March, so I was working with the Grameen Bank, I guess, in December and January, early this year. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to have a better sense of, they wanted to have a sense of what is actually going on in the field, because there's actually no one who sees it besides the field worker themselves. And then they wanted to take that information, come back with it, and figure out how to make it better. So to figure out exactly what the needs of the clients were, what they actually wanted to know, what they don't need to know, like what's kind of reinventing the wheel to them and what's stuff that's really relevant, you know?
So actually some more of this feedback that you were talking about, getting some more of the information from the loan recipients back up through the bank itself?
Yeah, they were interested in sort of putting that more in place, because although it's there, it's an informal mechanism. So they wanted to have some, like a formalized process in place where they could do that. And they were also interested in having more of sort of a training component for the field workers. They have like a one-year mandatory placement in the field. All of the workers at Grameen Bank, including the people in the head office. So during that, they wanted to have a training component that specialized just in communication, just to sort of also, just to get a sense of what, who the clients really are, right? Like not only what their needs are, but who they are. Like just to have a sense of really who you're dealing with and why.
And what about the field workers themselves? Did you get a sense of why they were doing the work that they were doing? Who they were?
The field workers were kind of a varied group. Most of them were pretty young. Most of them, it was kind of their first job out of university. The ones that I met through BRAC were sort of interested in using it as a stepping stone to other jobs. The people who I seemed to meet at the Grameen Bank seemed much more heavily invested, I guess, in what they were actually doing and in terms of, like, the good that it does. And I don't know if I would generalize that to a Grameen Bank or BRAC thing. Just the people that I met seemed to sort of fall into those categories. But it was really interesting. Like, the workers that I was talking to with the Grameen Bank really were, like, they really were trying to make a difference. So.
Hmm. And do you think that any of the findings in terms of communication are relevant to other microcredit programs? Do you think other microcredit programs have this communication focus and could learn something from what you found in Bangladesh?
I mean, you know, why not? I mean, because there's, like, I mean, and of course in development, like, everyone's talking about participatory communication. And interpersonal communication is a major factor in that, of course, right? Because, I mean, face-to-face communication is, like, really the best way to get information across, to share information, to build knowledge. So, I mean, I don't, you know, why stop at microcredit? Every organization could benefit from my thesis.
So do you have any advice for people who are interested in going to Bangladesh or working in the area of communication or of microcredit?
Advice. Well, for people who are going to Bangladesh, I would say to keep an open mind. I would say to embrace kind of the chaos that's around you, because it's organized. It doesn't seem like that, but it is. To never cross the streets, because you could die. It's treacherous. And, and to just totally enjoy it, because it's an amazing place. For people who are getting involved in microcredit, I don't really know if I would give any advice. I don't really know what I could give. I think I still have a lot to learn about that. And what was the other thing that you said?
Communication and development.
Well, one thing I would like to see, you know, in the field of development communication is more literature on interpersonal communication. I mean, certainly for, you know, selfish reasons, but also because it's such an understudied area. It really is. And, you know, like I'm in the process of writing right now, and I'm really having a difficult time finding literature on it. And I just think it's such a gaping hole that no one has really addressed, because there's such a push now for all kinds of, like, you know, campaigns. Everything's a campaign, right? And everything is so big, but the little communications, like the one-to-one communication, like, no one really talks about it so much. One of the things that drew me to BRAC, actually, was that years ago in the 80s, they had an oral rehydration campaign they were doing when they wanted to teach people in rural areas how to make a saline solution to fight diarrhea in their infants. And they went door-to-door, and they taught everyone personally. And it took them 10 years. And I think they went back 5 years later to do sort of an assessment to see what their retention rate was. And they found it was something like 80%, which is a really, really high figure for retention rates in any kind of communication. And it just goes to show how valuable interpersonal communication can be. So, yeah, I would like to see more attention focused on that. But we'll see, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Thank you so much for being with us here today on Going Global.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
And I'm not sure if we have time for one more song or if we're going to go straight to the BBC. We've got one more song, actually. Howard, could you tell us a tiny bit about that song?
Well, it's another piece from a film. The film's called Kisna, and it's an instrumental theme.
This is the BBC World Service with Joe Fidgen at 17 hours GMT. At the end of what's shaping up to be the worst week in George W. Bush's presidency, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Lewis Scooter Libby, has just been indicted for his alleged role in the Plamegate scandal, the leaking of a CIA operative's name, apparently as part of a political vendetta.
He is accused of obstruction of justice, perjury and making false statements. The other central figure in the case, Karl Rove, President Bush's top political advisor, has not been charged.
Well, We'll be going live to our correspondents in Washington for the latest. In other news, as thousands vow to destroy Israel in Tehran, we'll be analysing the signs of Iran's renewed radicalisation. And European Union negotiators say they're offering unprecedented cuts in agriculture tariffs. Over the next half hour, we'll hear reports and analysis from the BBC's network of correspondents on these and the rest of today's main stories. And we'll begin with a news bulletin.
BBC News with Julie Candler. A senior aide to the United States Vice President has been charged with perjury and obstruction of justice. The charge against the aide, Lewis Libby, followed an investigation into the leaking of the identity of an American intelligence agent. Revealing the identity of CIA operatives is a federal offence in the USA. From Washington, Oliver Conway reports.
After months of tension at the White House over the investigation into whether anyone there leaked the identity of a CIA agent, the prosecutor has indicted the vice president's chief of staff, Lewis Libby. He is accused of obstruction of justice, perjury, and making false statements. The other central figure in the case, Karl Rove, President Bush's top political advisor, has not been charged, but he will remain under investigation. So the threat hanging over the White House will continue, even as it tries to handle the fallout from the indictment of one of the architects of the Iraq War.
2 days after provoking an international outcry by saying Israel should be wiped off the map,